let me hand it over now to Marcel Schindler, Urs von Buren, and Ariel Goldblatt from StepStone's private debt team. Can we please give presenter status to Ariel so she can control StepStone slides? The board has heard from Marcel, Urs, and Ariel before. Marcel and Urs are partners out of the Zurich office, and Ariel is a director out of New York. So, good evening and good afternoon, Marcel, Urs, and Ariel. Floor is yours.
Thanks, Rishi. If yeah, someone could give me the ability to share my screen, that would be great. Ah, perfect.
Good morning from New York and Zurich. Pleasure to see you all again, even though just virtually. And thanks very much to Rishi for this very comprehensive overview and introduction, which I believe will make it easier to understand us credit nerds in the following presentation. First of all, and we just observed from very far here, obviously we would like to express our solidarity with everyone in California suffering from the current devastating wildfires that impact life quality, obviously, on top of the COVID-19 pandemic. We will discuss the latter, obviously, now in the review, the discussion today. And just as a personal matter, I can report that here over in Switzerland, we have been rather in a privileged situation in which our day-to-day life hasn't been limited or only marginally. The team today, yes, Ariel in New York, she will help me guide through the presentation here. I have Urs just sitting next to me. As you can see, we can share the same office here. Myself, I'm leading the private debt team globally. We're now in the fourth year of that mandate that we are managing, and I'm happy to report that we are on track with the originally set objectives. And at this stage, I wouldn't missed the opportunity to thank the board, the trustees, and the investment team for the trust and the excellent cooperation over the last years. Please, in the following, interrupt me for any questions that you are going to have, but I will now go over to part number one, which is the update on StepStone Group. I will try to keep this rather short. StepStone is and remains a private market specialist overseeing now close to 300 billion assets, whereof about 60 billion are managed on a discretionary basis. These assets are managed across private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and private debt, the team that we represent here. With allocations on an annual basis over 40 billion, we belong to the largest allocators globally, to the benefit ultimately of all our investors. StepStone stands for is dedicated to provide tailor-made solutions to investors, dedicated to a strong fundamental research that ultimately is reflected in our systems and database, which we make accessible to our clients. And last but not least, we continue to enlarge our global presence, making sure we are close to our investments and able to deliver locally. Which brings me to the next page, Ariel, where you can see that we are globally present in 13 countries, 19 offices. If you look at our client base, it's really global. More than 40% of our overall assets are outside of the US. Client base, institutional only. This means insurance companies, it's pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, that are all looking for tailor-made solution, like in the case of Contra Costa, but as well, all clients that are currently facing the same ongoing and prolonged challenge of the lowest ever yield environment, which is most likely to persist for much longer than we all expect or ever expected. And I will talk about it in a minute a bit more. Quickly on the next page to the team that is working on private debt. We had no team changes overall, but added additional resources and will continuously add to support the growth of our business. With a PD investment team overall of 50 investment professional, We are definitely among the largest advisory teams specialized on private debt globally. Now, very quickly, a very actual update to the group. You might have taken from the news that last week, StepStone has successfully concluded the IPO at NASDAQ. So the company is now listed. You might wonder or ask, why did we go for an IPO? I think the successful expansion of the business over the last year has led to an ongoing and continuous growth of financing need, financing the business. On the one hand side, with respect to GP commits that we have to do as well into our products, but as well to further develop systems, infrastructure, and people resources. Additionally, long-term incentives for employees are very important. Obviously, we have now a tool at hand that supports this, and we have taken the occasion with the IPO to really broadly make participation for all employees on all levels. Mid to long term, it will be a tool as well to do succession planning. We have announced last year the appointment of a co-CEO as well, and it's all in light of a mid to long term transition in the business as well, and to make sure we can serve our clients. Ultimately, we believe as well the IPO is a tool that will provide to our investors transparency. Now, if it comes to the private debt team, just as a side mark here, the private debt team, which is owned as well by the partners in the private debt business, the shareholding structure between StepStone and this team remains unchanged, and as well, the team will continue. So hopefully we have the pleasure to serve you for many additional years in the same team format. I stop here quickly after part one. With respect to the group update, are there any questions? In this case, I will move on to the private debt market update. And I'd like to start with the COVID-19. Obviously, and I would say going through the third or the fourth cycle already in my life, the first time that I accept the word unprecedented, because I think we never had an event where suddenly everything came to a stop. And in this sense, it's really unprecedented. Now, the slide that I'm referring here to shows the approach we have taken to this event. And it's a slide and an approach that we have defined early in April of this year at the beginning of the event. And I think it's important to see here that we have realized early that pure bottom-up analysis of individual companies and borrowers will not be sufficient in the long term, because we have too many factors top-down that can influence the development going forward. So we need help to see the forest for the trees in a top-down approach. We have done intensive bottom-up analysis of all borrowers in your portfolio, obviously jointly with the GPs, but we have done as well, additionally, early in May, an analysis of the overall market where we analyzed over 4,000 borrowers and interviewed 100 GPs to better understand what the short and mid-term impact actually of COVID really means to the US, but as well the European mid-market. This study is, by the way, available on our webpage. Your investment team has that as well and might distribute if there is any interest. However, after all these bottom-up analysis again, we have seen that the lockdown measures, fiscal stimulus, monetary policy, but as well medical developments will for the foreseeable future influence the destiny of the borrowers, the companies, the sectors, which means it's taken out of hand partially of management, the equity sponsor, or the lender sometimes to really determine their own destiny. And in this sense, it was very important early to create scenarios of possible outcomes, which we update regularly and try to predict what could happen under different scenarios. So early we created, for example, a GFC-like scenario, figured in a recession. We were predicting already in April a peak default rate in the sub-investment grade space of about 12%. By the way, a number which was confirmed just 2 months ago by Moody's, in order to simulate and understand what can happen in a portfolio and how do we need to react to this together with our GPs. Now, luckily, looking at the recent developments, the current situation looks much more positive. Moody's has revised a bit the predicted cumulative default rates more from 8 towards 8 and 10%. Currently, we're probably between 4 and 5%. And definitely, it's something we monitor, considering, you know, potential as well second lockdown that might come into the market. Now, looking at your portfolio, definitely, I think the investment approach that we have determined initially with the investment team was very helpful because it was focused, first of all, to be positioned in senior loans, collateralized. So first, lien lending, that was the priority. And second, we were always looking out for diversification. Diversification across GPs, single position and sectors. Definitely one factor that helped a lot because I always mentioned this time it was a biological virus. If this would have been a computer virus that stopped the world for 3 months, the sector impacts and everything else would look completely different. So because it was unprecedented, the only measure that really helped the portfolio was good diversification. Now, very quickly, the key events in credit markets that you see on page number 8. And here, just a comparison in the gray lines that you see, that was the credit market correction during global financial crisis 2008. And the colored lines show the same, actually the syndicated loan market as a representative for credit during now the COVID crisis. What you see, the drawdown or the correction was about 2/3 of GFC, but it was much faster. Not just on the way down, but as well on the recovery. So absolutely not seen before. What it showed as well in this correction, which is different to previous correction, there is a larger bifurcation in the market in terms of credit quality. So the good versus the troubled. It's a bifurcation as well geographically. It's a bifurcation, unfortunately, as well as we can see and note socially. What we see here in the graph as well on the dotted lines, just to draw your attention to, is that the direct lending exposure to credits have been more resilient. So they had to face less drawdowns. And you touched before with a question regarding valuation. There has been mark to market on many of the position. Impairments have been considered early. We always run our internal rating system on each and every position in parallel to cross-check what the managers are actually doing. And yes, obviously, the drawdown and the correction has been much lower. Now, on the next page, you just see quickly that the key events in credit markets and the rating agency this time have reacted very quickly. With an unprecedented speed, they have and magnitude, they have downgraded companies across the investment grade and sub-investment grade spectrum. And obviously, that's always a sign for defaults that will pick up over time, which you see in the chart below. As I mentioned, we're currently above the historical default rate, so we're more in the 4 to 5% range. And what you see as well was the different predictions that we have, which could go up to 14, 15%, but might be as well as low as the historical median. Now here, it's the way that we work with scenarios to consider what happens in the market and to better understand. Now, maybe one word with respect to defaults. Defaults are not always necessarily bad. Defaults do not always mean credit loss, especially in the direct lending market where credit covenants are much tighter. And defaults occur much earlier in the process for restructuring a company and protect the value ultimately for the lender. Now, with this, maybe quickly to the outlook on the next page and a few comments here. I talked about the V-shaped recovery that we have observed so far. We fear, obviously, and are still doubtful if this recovery can be maintained or if there will be a derail over time because we have, again, second waves and shutdowns. You've observed that in Europe. Ireland and Great Britain are just the latest example. We have more cases in Spain and France, obviously, and the US isn't over the hill either. Definitely what we expect midterm is a growth moderation, not just in the short term, but truly as well in the mid to long term, especially as well to the future tax burdens that will come. Definitely, global interest rates will stay low, and they will stay low for much longer than we all expected, at levels really unprecedented. And what we observe as well is, due to the central bank measures that have been taken, a certain disconnect between traded markets and obviously the fundamentals that we observe. This leads us a bit to some of the investment principles, which we go into in the following section. I think it remains very clear the focus in investment needs to stay on quality on the core investment, so in the direct lending. There is no place in these portfolios to take extra risk in our mind, so we want to stay firstly and in senior. If we want to enhance portfolios, we believe there are, due to the bifurcation and dislocation in the market, opportunities in other market segments that we can use. And we definitely looking together with the investment team for additional less correlated asset classes that might be investable.
Question for you.
Please.
With respect to the defaults and the default rate, is there any correlation in the default numbers with later credit placements that have, for lack of a better term, been characterized by covenant light? I think for the past year or two, at least in the private credit realm, every conference or presentation I've heard talks about the fact that over time in the private credit space, the covenants have begun to be less restrictive, and that sort of mirrored what happened in a roughly parallel way. But, you know, for the GFC, which was, you know, the lessening of standards, the lessening of protections, greater lending. So have you seen a correlation in the default rates that you've described in relation to the vintage of the placement and whether it was affected by covenants?
This is a very good point you touch upon, and we've addressed it as well in a late cycle study that we have done. Now, maybe first of all, very important that tendency that you described, the trend to going more covenant light, has been predominant in the traded market, the syndicated loan market. Over the last years, we have observed this getting into the direct lending market as well. But because we manage through separately managed accounts with rather tight investment guidelines, we try to avoid to 100% any type of covenant light loans. I think that's, first of all, a major statement here. Now, regarding correlation, it's an interesting question. It's very early to determine what the ultimate loss is going to be. But I think what you're going to find and what you've probably seen in previous cycle as well and really repeat itself, actual credit losses will definitely most likely correlate higher in the area of covenant light loans. Because if there are no covenants that bite early and you cannot intervene to optimize the restructuring process to protect the senior lender, you will have lower recovery rates in case of a default and your losses will be higher. So there is a correlation more between losses and covenant lights. Now, defaults actually is the contrary, if you think about it. So the more covenants that you had on the contract, actually, the earlier actually you have the risk to have earlier a default and second, even more defaults. And as I mentioned before, default might not be a bad thing. A default just shows you breach the covenant principally, and you sit at the table and you want to make sure that you get the best out of a situation. The problem is in covenant light loans that you be not be able to sit at a table. You need to wait too long. You cannot intervene. And maybe you get to the worst default, which is a payment default where the company really cannot pay anymore. And then you will suffer credit losses.
Thank you. It's helpful.
You're welcome. With this, I would just do the introduction, how we see the private debt market going forward, the attractiveness of private credit in general on slide number 12. And I always position this and compare this to the public alternatives that you have on the fixed income space and on the equity space, which in my mind, both feel major challenges. Needless to discuss where we stand on the rate side, on the fixed income. You get something for your money, don't know if it protects inflation over time, but here in Switzerland, we're already down minus 75 to 100 basis points. So I lose money every day that I stay in cash or stay liquid. The downgrades are coming into the fixed income world, so it's getting more challenged. And so we believe, and there has been the first test, the core allocation, the more defensive allocation in senior direct lending is a very good long-term substitute for these type of fixed income strategies. On the other hand side, if you look at the higher return potential and you look at equities, we believe that based on the recent development, equities will face some challenges as well. I believe we will see more volatility in the market. First of all, we talked about the muted growth, which globally, which we probably will all agree. So a major driver of equity returns. And last but not least, I believe because debt will be available to a lesser extent going forward, many of the dividend streams, but as well share buybacks, which were important equity value drivers in the past, will not be there. So there is a challenge on the equity side as well. But on the other hand, private debt has as well some other strategies like distressed or opportunistic lending, so not just the defense side, where we believe there are opportunities coming up, which we review with your team, which actually have equity-like returns, but ultimately they have more downside protection because we will still be on the debt side on top of equity. And so we have more protection. And I think that's a bit how we position private debt. And with this, I would like to hand over to my partner, Urs.
Thank you, Marcel. Good morning, everybody. And thanks for the opportunity to talk to you again. Marcel already talked about default rates here in a slightly different format. The upper end of page 15 shows the syndicated the S&P loan market, and the middle one, the Credit Suisse loan market. The default rates have gone beyond the long-term average, which is about 2.75%. So the Credit Suisse is almost double of what it was in March, and more than a percent above. The lower chart shows that the gray bars are the really interesting part. That's the rating downgrades. Now, the interpretation of rating downgrades can be twofold. Either there's a lot more problems to come, or it was an overreaction of the rating agencies, because in 2008 and 2009, they were always accused to be too slow and not reacting whatsoever. We believe it's probably the truth is somewhere in between, because the recent recovery and opening up of economies, etc., has shown some positives. As Marcel already alluded, what is to come in the next 1 or 2 quarter with regards to possible further shutdowns, etc., difficult. But it's probably the downgrades were a little bit an overreaction in certain areas. What does that mean for the direct lending market environment on page 60? I'm touching on four topics: the volumes of transactions, the pricing, the documentation and underwriting standards, and obviously the default and losses going forward as well. Transaction volumes, they were down significantly, very little in April, May and June. They have since picked up massively since early July. September is one of the busiest months we've actually have on record with us on StepStone. Nevertheless, volumes will be down 30-40% for the year. So this almost no activity for 3-4 months will impact the overall volumes quite substantially. As I said, they will ultimately pick up because private equity has a lot of money to invest, so the volumes will come back. But we've also seen more large borrowers because some syndicated loan issuers or high yield issuers chose to go and work with a non-bank, one of the direct lenders. So that was an interesting observation, and we believe that will continue for another couple of quarters. Pricing, we indicate 100 to 250. It's more at the lower end of the range, especially for companies that have done well during the crisis. But nevertheless, it's 50 to 100. 125 basis points more than pre-COVID. We are also looking at secondary transactions, portfolios to buy, and also share such observations with the team, because there are some sellers out there that want to raise liquidity. Documentation and underwriting standards, that's actually the strongest of the 4 points. Definitely less aggressive, lower leverage, about half a turn to a turn of less debt, better protection, more covenants, tighter covenants. That's a fairly strong point. And with new transactions going forward that we still add to the portfolio, we believe that the loss rates in the future will be reduced because better pricing, better protection, lower leverage. So on a risk adjusted basis, what we invest since April, May, June, and going forward for the next few quarters should have attractive risk adjusted returns. On page 17, and again, please interrupt me when you have questions. On page 17, I kind of repeat what Rishi said and what Marcel already said in a different way by showing the loss rates that a specific vintage experienced in the future years. So when I'm looking at 2007, the annual loss rates of the 2007 vintage, which was clearly pre-crisis, were 293 basis points per year in the following years. These losses obviously occurred in 2009, 10, and 11. But if we took at the vintage, the losses were 293 basis points. Not little, but still the returns were firmly positive. And that's a very important element. Obviously, in the last few years, there were almost no losses, and we will now have the real test, as already alluded, with the asset class being much bigger. How are we going through this crisis, and how is the overall loan market handling this situation, or the direct lending market? The decision of the investment team to ramp over time and not do it as fast as possible certainly turns out to be a good approach, because we still have plenty of dry powder left to invest in 2020, 21, and build the portfolio to its target size, because you can also see that 2009 and 10 have very low loss rates, and these are all fully repaid. These are realized, that's an attractive vintage. And you see that the spread with 800 and 700 above LIBOR is obviously quite high. When I move on to the opportunities that we see in slightly different words again, we look at defense and offense, and after a disruption that we've seen, there's always plenty of opportunities. Again, the mandate is set up to actually allow to take advantage of opportunities, so play the defense with the core direct lending allocation, 55% to 75%, and add opportunities if and when they arrive. We had in the past certain investments in higher yielding strategies. There's just one going through the system as of the end of the month, which is expected to obviously capitalize on the opportunity. And we talk about ongoing situations with the deal team on a bi-weekly basis. The investment themes kind of come up in different phases. We look at three phases. The first phase, the up, the down, very sharp, and very sharp back up. That phase is firmly over, and Sasera does that through other means than our mandate. Our mandate is not doesn't have the task to address this. We're somewhere at the beginning, which we call a recession, where we have opportunistic credit, opportunistic lending, secondary loan portfolios. We review situation and update the team, as I said, on a bi-weekly basis. Phase three is evolving, because the real distress will probably only start in 2021, but we are updating the universe and getting ready to select interesting opportunities to take advantage of that. The last slide just gives you a bit of an impression how many themes there are, because again, Rishi pointed out, and one of you members as well, that it's a very, very broad universe, and you kind of can see that here. And you see the dark blue buttons circles are where we have invested money in discretionary accounts, and the gray circles are where we are spending time to review the universe, the opportunity, the volumes that can be invested. So we are very broadly covering a lot of themes, which we obviously keep your investment team up to date, and we have plenty of things to discuss during our regular catch-ups. That was it for investment themes and an overview. Happy to take questions if you have any.
Yeah, I definitely have one, and that is in terms of what recovery looks like and what the opportunity set is, what strikes me about the current situation, and I think everybody has the same thought, it's so different than a GFC or prior cycles, where the emergence out of the worst of this may have a completely different look in whole or in part going forward. The old recovery looked more like, people got back to work, the economy was robust, life went on. And I keep reading, and again, read this morning, the plight of New York and London and other major metropolitan areas where you have firms that simply haven't returned to the core and may not. And may have already, by adaptive learned behavior, decided they don't need to have a lot of people in one place for as many people as they used to have. And it seems to me that's something that's a work in progress going on. How do you account for that and looking at the opportunity set? Because it seems like the future may look a whole lot different than prior recoveries have in the past.
Well, you raise that challenging question. Obviously, we don't have a crystal ball, nor do the GPs. Just one example: dental health, dental practices. They were really shut down, but the reopening also showed that the visitor levels shoot up to about 80-85% rather quickly. The expectations also are that not a full-scale shutdown, they may actually be excluded. Now, if we do have a transaction, which we had a couple that GPs did, how do you look at those? You have a revised budget. You're more conservative in your growth assumptions. You're more conservative in any adjustments you may make for things that the management team of the firm wants to invest. You give less debt and you ask for a higher price because it's clearly an impacted business. So you structure it more conservatively. And on top of that, that's the really well-structured businesses. It doesn't always happen, or transactions. You include a cash buffer in a new transaction for 6, 9, or 12 months that ensures, because you kind of have a good feeling of the cash burn, that ensures that it's a sufficient liquidity for 6, 9, 12 months. So you structure more conservatively, your assumptions are less aggressive, and this is also why the outcomes are much, much more predictable, because one needs this additional level of certainty because of the uncertainty that you alluded to.
Yeah, my question probably was focused, weighted anyway, in the commercial real estate debt area, principally.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay. our colleagues from the real estate team on the equity side, and we work together for real estate debt. That is a question that nobody really has an answer yet. I think we believe the assumptions that a lot of people make are a little bit more on the positive end, but one shouldn't expect. If you talk to bankers and GPs, etc., they all say we will go back to the office eventually. Nothing is as good as sitting together, maybe not every day anymore, but on a very regular basis. So the jury is out, and I believe futures of financings that are being put together now are definitely much less aggressive. Maybe Marcel would like to add a couple of thoughts here.
You raise with the commercial real estate a very interesting question, in the sense of, and we had this schematic, you know, slide with the phases of dislocation to recession to recovery. Now, what we observe is obviously what makes this correction very, very different. Everything is impacted. You know, and there are second and third order impacts that we need now to analyze. You're absolutely correct. Second order impacts like demand, supply, not just on real estate. You know, think about normal supply chain that you have. Are you gonna, you know, we all learned at university just in time, you know, Japanese system. Do you really gonna rely on that going forward? What is the consequence of that? You have multiple suppliers, it will be more expensive, it lowers margins. This all needs to be factored in, but the second, third order impact effects, they only come now slowly. On commercial real estate, for me, is still far out. So truly, I shy a bit away because it's too far out for me still to see. What we see as well, if you look at the schematic slide, is these phases now run in parallel, you know, this dislocation, market price dislocation, recession and recovery partially, depending on sectors, companies, and different segments. Very interesting. So truly, I believe that we will still see market price dislocation going forward, because the market priced already back to perfection and volatility will come back. So everything runs much more in parallel, and it's very different than whatever we have seen before. So the only approach you can have here is being cautious, stay on the debt side on top of the capital structure and be as diversified as possible.
Thanks, appreciate it.
That leaves us.
Go ahead.
Excuse me, sorry.
No, I was just going to see if there were any other trustee questions at this time. Is that you, Jerry?
Yeah, I had a thought. I think the real test, just my personal belief, on commercial real estate is going to be on the renewal, lease renewal front, and see what kinds of opportunities come up. And that's where the, you know, it's really going to be come to Jesus time, whether or not these companies are going to decide to keep their obligations, which I believe they will, although maybe a little pared down, or dump them. I think that's really going to be a chance for them to say, you know, do we like this model of everybody working outside, or are we more interested in seeing some return to normal? I don't see a collapse, just an observation on my part, a collapse of the commercial real estate industry, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens as these leases roll over.
Would you agree?
And again, the equity will suffer first. If you still have 25-ish percent of equity underneath any kind of debt, that part is lost first. And once you start losing money, 25% of a previous valuation has disappeared, which is already quite substantial when it comes to commercial real estate. That's again why we prefer debt.
One of the other interesting ones for me, at least, is to see what happens on travel and leisure, hospitality, airlines. I just don't see much of a snapback on that. I see Carnival Cruise Line just announced that they've got, you know, 18 of their ships for sale. The airlines are running out of their help money on October 1st or something, as I recall. And I think there's going to be a real shakeout in the travel and entertainment and travel and hospitality business.
Absolutely. I mean, this part of the bifurcation that I mentioned in terms of credit quality sectors, but as well, certain countries, you know, which struggle to come back. You know, you take an economy like Italy, for example, you know, you just need to take a sector. It can be a country, huge bifurcation. But what you see is obviously some of the loser areas, I would say they're already determined, but not to be underestimated, unless we all agree we never will fly again, as well for ecological reason. I believe there will be winners and losers in there, but that to capture this opportunity set, you might need more time, and definitely you need more specialized GPs in that space that look into this. So that is something we are very careful and cognizant of. You know, many of the direct lenders would now start looking at opportunities because they think, oh, there are so many opportunities out there. We believe looking at opportunities needs high specialization in sectors, in countries, in whatever you name to capture them. Because there will be these opportunities, the winners and losers out of these difficult and troubled industries.
Any other trustee questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, Urs, Marcel, Ariel, thank you so much for this presentation. Very informative.
We have a few more slides, if that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. Yeah, of course. And I will try on the next couple of slides to be relatively quick and just hit the high points, as both Tim and Rishi, I think, did a great job summarizing the relationship and where we are today. So, you know, as both Tim and Rishi mentioned, we started the mandate in 2017 and have worked closely with the Sesera management team to implement the program since then. As of June 30th, about $845 million has been committed to both core and satellite managers, and another almost $80 million has been cumulatively invested in co-investments. In terms of our outlook for the rest of 2020 and 2021, we'll continue implementing the mandate in close coordination with the Sesera management team, and potentially add one new SMA, three additional primary funds, and continue to recycle co-investments as they get repaid. So Rishi and had in his slides a similar page. So there's no change to our current mandate. It's the asset allocation is up to 12% of Sicera's total AUM. The key mandate objectives include a primary focus on corporate debt, but other debt opportunities are not excluded, including, you know, real estate credit or regulatory capital, which adds some diversification to the portfolio. And as Rishi mentioned also, you know, we are seeking to generate a 10% return over a cycle. So as we turn to the pacing analysis, so in conjunction with the Sicera management team, you know, the ramp up of the portfolio has been elongated to about 3 to 4 years, but pacing remains on track. As we discussed, in terms of our priorities for the next, 12 to 18 months, we plan to commit $150 million to one new SMA, about $120 million to three new primary funds, and then continue to recycle co-investments as opportunities arise. And then this slide shows you a little bit about the dialogue we've had with the Sicera management team. So what you can see is that since inception, as well as throughout the last year, we've had a regular dialogue with the Sicera team, you know, including 26 biweekly calls, an in-person meeting at Sicera's offices when that was still, you know, possible, to discuss some portfolio construction. We've also had several ad hoc discussions on specific topics, as well as set up meetings with pre-selected GPs, and reviewed many different asset classes with the Sicera management team. So one of the accomplishments during the last year is we implemented a $100 million upsize to a current core manager, as well as added several new co-investments. We're currently, as both Marcel and Orr has discussed, we're currently reviewing opportunities with the Sicera management team that have come to light, you know, on the back of COVID-19, and we'll continue to do so in conjunction with the Sicera team. A little bit on the private debt performance. So, as I mentioned, as of June 30th, commitments were $845 million. There are three SMAs, four primary funds, and almost 20 co-investments. And as of the end of the year last year, the portfolio had generated a gross IRR of 11.3% and a net IRR of 10.7%. Now, as we've discussed COVID-19, as a result of markdowns in the first quarter of 2020, the portfolio experienced a temporary reduction in IRR to 4.1%. What we want to highlight is that this temporary decline was primarily driven by non-cash valuation adjustments. There was no material impact to cash yield. And importantly, you know, Q2 valuations are rebounding, are showing rebound in valuations and an improvement in gross IRR. And lastly, what I'd like to point out, and as we tried to point out earlier in the presentation as well with Marcel and Orr's, is that the portfolio remains of a very high quality. It's highly diversified with over 200 borrowers. 97% of the borrowers have a covenant. Almost 100% of the borrowers are senior secured. And we've got very low leverage levels at about 4.5 times. So this portends a very conservative and high quality portfolio for the Sicera portfolio. If there are no questions, I'll move on to the performance section. So as you can see, we have compared the Stepstone CC portfolio across a variety of benchmarks. Through March 31st, the Stepstone CC portfolio has outperformed the benchmarks despite the impact of COVID-19. And even though COVID-19 dampened the returns, I think it's quite important to note that the volatility was limited and much less than the liquid asset classes, as Marcel also pointed out in his slides. You know, and in addition, as I mentioned on the previous slide, you know, preliminary indications for Q2 indicate a rebound in valuations and IRRs. And then the last two pages, and then happy to take any questions, talk about the portfolio at more of a fund level. So from a cash flow perspective, as of June 30th, the fund had deployed $162 million to underlying investments. About 72% of that deployment was from core managers since inception, 15% to primary funds and about 11% from co-invests. And then lastly, on the last slide, you know, as I mentioned on slide 28, this portfolio remains of high quality. It's highly diversified by industry, as you can see, with a focus on North America. Direct lending represents over 90% of the fund level exposure, with further diversification with real estate credit and regulatory capital making up the remainder of the portfolio. So we are happy to take any additional questions on the summary of the investment program, as well as the performance and the portfolio.
Ariel, let me ask you to flesh out the new SMA. We now have three. We're going to add one more. That's going to have a series of investments. Can you give me some idea, what you envision those investments will be, and how will they differ from the other three?
Yeah, so I think our goal is going to be to add a little bit more diversification to the Sisera portfolio. So, for example, we're looking at the lower middle market as one opportunity. But on the back of COVID, we also want to spend some time looking at opportunistic opportunities in this market. As you know, Sisera's core portfolio is purely direct lending. And so, and borrowers are around, you know, on average about $50 million plus in EBITDA size. So a lower middle market opportunity would be in the, call it, $10 to $20 million EBITDA range, and would have much tighter pricing, covenants, terms, et cetera. And the opportunistic is an opportunity to take advantage of the current environment. And I'll let Orza and Marcel also jump in if they have additional thoughts.
No, nothing to add to that. Thank you, Ariel.
Does that help answer your question?
Yes. I talking about larger versus smaller, and as they get smaller, I'm assuming there's a manager in the middle of all each of the loans, so that a loan we now have from a smaller entity, a $10 million loan, it still goes through a manager's analysis, evaluation, approval, et cetera. You're overseeing that process. But the smaller you get, it seems to me the greater the risk becomes. I assume the higher the return.
So we would
just getting a flavor for that.
Yeah, of course. So a couple points on that. First, you're right, it would be the same process. You would always have a manager that's overseeing the loan. But we've done several studies, which obviously we'd be happy to share, that show that contrary to, you know, to the belief that a smaller company would have higher default rates, it's actually not true. We shared this data with the Sisera management team, and what you'd find in fact is that, you know, that $10 to $20 million borrower actually has, you know, sometimes lower default rates as a result of the fact that there's less leverage, the terms are much tighter, pricing is appropriate, and you're doing the same diligence on these borrowers as well with a reputable manager. So surprisingly, we would not expect the default rates and or payment default rates to go up when we focus on the lower middle market. It would be more that you get exposure to different types of companies, so more diversification as well as better terms than you can get as you move up the EBITDA spectrum.
The only point to add, it's actually the loss rates that are similar or even in some cases lower than other areas. The default rates, as we said, because tighter covenant may be slightly higher, but the risk adjusted returns, so the ultimate return that Sisera and other investors walk away with, has in general a higher quality or the same quality as other segments of the market.
Could I ask a couple of questions on the IPO to throw you totally a curve there? The IPO,
as far as I'm allowed to say anything yet, please.
Oh no, you're a public company now, so you're allowed more than you ever imagined. So, are you thinking of buying, Jerry? Sorry. Are you thinking of buying? I am not. But it was interesting. I noticed that you came out at, you priced about 17, 18 bucks a share or something. And so it didn't get all the attention that Snowflake did. I'm really sorry that it didn't get that much buzz. But it still looks as to me as if you've done pretty well initially. So it's about 25 bucks a share. So my first question is, what's the lockout period for you folks?
You know, for us folks in general, we have a minimum depending on 6 to 9 months. But I mean, as well, you know, looking at the partnership and what is the purpose of what we are doing here, similar to other asset managers, you will find going as well forward looking that the partners will be the dominant driving force, even in the new construct, even if it's public now. So that will be unchanged.
And my follow-up question, which is, you made a little tongue-in-cheek joke there about to the extent I can share that information. You're now a public company. So what additional pressures do you guys anticipate, or the partners anticipate, with regard to possibly a strategic directional change, now that there's going to be considerable added pressure on you to look at price-to-earnings ratios and profits and that sort of thing? Is that likely, in your mind, going to change the strategic direction of StepStone as to where they place their emphasis?
No, not really, truly. I mean, if we, you know, if you look at the strategic development of a company like ours, there have been various strategic options which we evaluated, not just in interest of the previous shareholders, the partners, which are still the majority shareholder, if you think about it. But as well, obviously, for our clients. And the question is, how can we assure as long as possible growth and independence to a large extent? So obviously, companies like ours and similar size could do as they have as well other strategic options. They might have a strategic buyers. That was something typically that we always shied away, because definitely that will jeopardize the independence that we had for our institutional investors. Now, obviously, public means releasing earnings. And definitely, now, if it comes just to the pure fact that gathering the data and reporting and everything, yes, that's slight hassle and more work. We do all agree on that. And by the way, I was in my previous life already CFO of a public company, so I know what that means for a certain period of time. But does this mean earnings pressure that we change our business model? No, really not, because we're here for the long-term benefits of our clients, which we believe is as well the long-term benefit of our shareholders. Any short-term deviation due to earnings releases or results would jeopardize the long-term, you know, safeguarding of our clients, which is the major assets that we have. So I do not expect that this will drive the strategy of StepStone going forward.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think now we did get to the end of the presentation. I'm happy to answer any more questions.
That's good, because our chairman is double parked.
The one time I don't call,
you would have been already told.
My apologies on that. Like I said, that's why you should follow along on your iPad and not just the screen. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none. Well, again, thank you very much for the presentation. Very useful.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jamal. See you. Bye.
And I'll attempt to stop sharing my screen now.
Great. Thank you. Is there anyone needing a short break at this time, or should we power through?
I sent you a note offline that I'm going to need to duck off for about 20 minutes. I will come back, but I got something I can't avoid. But,
okay. Thanks.
So, Jay Kwan, if you're on, you're up for all of the important votes. So, I'm going to duck off.
Got it.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay, last chance for someone. Okay, seeing none. We'll